Blog Talk Radio. Welcome to today's broadcast of Firefly Willows LIVE. This week, we're doing something a little different. Our hosts are the guests. We've invited longtime friend and associate of the Carousellas, Joe G., to act as our host and moderator for an in-depth conversation on what we're all about and what makes us so great as a group. Listen in as Mildred Lynn, Hi C, John, and Deb talk about who we are, why we're here, and where we hope to go in the future. We're excited. Give us a listen. Firefly Willows LIVE, helping you find and shine your inner light.
Welcome to a special edition of the Firefly Willows LIVE Roundtable. With us today are our four regular co-hosts, Deb Carousella, Mildred Lynn McDonald, Hi C. Lutmers, and myself, John Carousella. And for this roundtable, we have decided to put ourselves on the table as a topic for our discussion. And to assist us with that, we've invited a very special colleague and friend of mine,
Joe,
my friend Joe, who is a member of the high-tech community, an executive in Silicon Valley, all-around amazing guy whom I have known for probably 20-plus years. And I know that Joe will tease out of us some very interesting perspectives, and I'm very excited to see what happens. So with that in mind, let's cut to the quick and turn the microphone over to Joe and have him lead us through a discussion that we hope will be engaging and entertaining. Joe?
Thanks, John. I'm really excited to be here. I'm a fan of the show. I've had a chance to listen to many of the programs that you guys have put on. Really, I'd like to start out with just going around the table here and asking each of you what motivated you to do this. Clearly, this takes an effort. Clearly, this is an amount of rich content that you folks are assembling to share with your audience. And I know I was inspired by various pieces of it. And I'm just really looking for that initial motivation that drew you to start this effort. And then we can get into some of the details after that. So who'd like to start?
I guess I'd like to start. I'm Mildred Lynn. I was sitting in the Gatineau Hills in Canada, and I was reflecting on a recent trip I had to California and about TV and about the messages that were given out based on either fear or, let's say you had a headache, well, you need extra strong strength just to get ready in case you ever have a headache. So I was thinking about those messages and how they bombard people. So as I was sitting there looking at the trees and looking at nature, what came to me was, we have an opportunity to present an alternate voice. And as I sat there and I thought, well, what does that alternate voice look like? Someone's face came into me and it was Hi C. So I immediately picked up the phone and I said to Hi C, I'd like to do a radio show. I think there's an opportunity. Will you not be thrilled to work with me, Hi C? To that, Hi C paused, one of those long pregnant pauses, and said, Mildred, let's discuss it a little more. When you actually moved to California, I was not put off. I was not put off, and I know he was very genuine when he said that. And after that, the next people that came in to me were John and Deb Carousella, because I knew what fabulous work they were doing and what courage it took to step away from mainstream conventional lifestyle and step into the world of energy work. So talked to John and Deb, and they were game. Seemed like we were all ready to embark on something like this. And before you knew it, in January, we were all sitting having a nice cup of tea and Studio C in Los Altos. At least that's my take.
Excellent. Well, Hi C, you seem to be the logical next party there to pipe in. So how did you embrace this and get yourself motivated up to do something like this?
I had actually thought about some sort of radio show or something like that for a while. And part of the motivation was being able to do it with other people meant it felt a little less like it was all going to be on my shoulders and I have to figure it all out, versus there was a not just a shared responsibility, but you had people to bounce ideas off of and figure things out and not feel quite so self-pressured, if you will. And I also think it's a really good opportunity. I mean, this is one of the things that technology offers us nowadays, is an ability to reach people in far-flung places and also in places where they may not have access to this kind of thing. Because somebody sitting, say, in the middle of a rural place where they are interested in this kind of topic but don't have access to it, or the environment that they're in doesn't necessarily support or is very encouraging of this kind of thing, it's not like having to be on a radio station, because with the internet, we're able to reach those people and they can access, hear about, learn about these things, even if they don't have something around them. And I always thought that was very important, because in the work that I do, like with Tarot, I have clients all over the world, and I've had people like in the military in Kuwait call me for a reading, you know, and stuff, which obviously is great because they can contact me, say, through Skype, mm-hmm. when otherwise, before that, they would have just had to be in Kuwait to not have access to that kind of thing. So this to me seemed like a really logical step to start being able to take that to people in places where they may not have access to it. And it also makes it a little less intimidating for somebody to explore it without having to go into a store or worry about asking a person concerned, what will that person think if they're not into that, or if they have a negative view of that, are they going to then, you know, judge me or reject me or something. So, and you can listen to it in your car, you can listen to it wherever you are, mm-hmm. so you can kind of take it with you. And that was another benefit I really thought, because I listen to a lot of podcasts, and being able to listen to that, if somebody's stuck in traffic, being able to listen to this versus, say, the kind of things Mildred was referring to, which is just constant advertising, oftentimes fear-based advertising, it gives you a little bit of something different to fill your space and time with that may be more beneficial versus chipping away at that sense of self or self-confidence.
But you bring up a good point about the portability, the convenience with which we can take tiny slices of time and leverage those slices to, you know, some productive input like this sort of thing. All right, you two of the Carousel clan, who's piping in next?
I'm here because I like all of these people and I enjoy spending time with them and doing things with them, and I am the person who weaves everything together. I keep sort of a continuation going between segments, and I do all the little spots in between. So the voice that you hear when you're not hearing one of our hosts is mine. And
it's lovely, by the way.
Thank you. And so from a purely selfish kind of point of view, I do voiceover work. And so this was a perfect way for me to continue to practice that art, that experience, to get more experience doing it, and to feel comfortable with being in front of the microphone, even if that microphone is in a studio in my house. So the opportunity to be here and to meet with these people, to listen to the content that they create, listen to the people they speak with, help them to build their shows, that's why I'm here.
Mm. And we were also very selfish because we knew having her be part of it meant we had a built-in voice artist to do some of that. Also somebody who already had a little bit of experience with some of the technology in terms of like editing and the tools that you use in that regard. So that was also very...
coming, you know, in a package you don't mind having around. So that's a bonus.
That's right.
Well, we won't let you totally off the hook for your contributions. We'll come back to that.
Okay.
But John, why don't you wrap us up here on motivation?
Well, I have to be honest with you. When we first started this, I had no idea why we were doing it. I had no idea why I was doing it, other than Mildred Lynn's been a pretty reliable compass for a lot of decisions for me as I've changed lanes on the freeway, so to speak, out of high tech and into energy work. So I'm inclined to listen very carefully when Mildred Lynn has an inspiration and a gut feeling about something being right. Now, to be fair, in conjunction with that, I have had experience in documentary films, and my participation in those taught me something very important, and that is that one of the most powerful tools we have to get a message across is the media, right? It's film, right? So ultimately, you know, when you see something on the big screen or you see something on television, the power that is carried in that medium is extraordinary. Now, radio isn't television. Radio isn't the big screen, but it's one of those kinds of media that is a powerful carrier. I didn't know what it was that I was going to use this medium to carry. I don't know what the payload was, but I'm starting to get the hang of it as I embrace the idea of doing the show. You know, and you know, producing the show is fun. It's creative. I love the idea that I get to talk with really interesting people. And you know, I'm starting to realize that, you know, and initially I thought this show would be some kind of means to some end. And now I'm starting to think, well, maybe I don't have to look at it that way. Maybe the show itself is a productive, effective tool all by itself. And that's the thing that's starting to bloom. is starting to evolve for me. So something is starting to, something has germinated and is starting to grow that I'm still trying to figure out what it is, but so far so good.
Interesting. I would say in my limited experience in even high-tech marketing, getting over the hurdle of production was required energy, required commitment, and actually was deferred and, you know, procrastinated, you know. And frankly, what I think maybe what you're seeing is that now that you guys have an established show, the real content and the real germination of what you can create with it will now be more effectively released. By the way, that's the way business works. When people start to really perform in business, they're performing because they've established the structure, they've established the way that they operate as a company, and then they start getting the rhythm and the motion of what can be done with a group of people that are collaborating to produce value.
And this is very interesting because at the very beginning, Mildred Lynn and I had very diametrically opposed perspectives on what was happening. Mildred Lynn was all, you were very enthusiastic about the progress we were making.
Exactly, yeah.
You know,
because I feel from my perspective, we were not only hammering out the logistics and learning how to work together in terms of dynamics, but we were delivering excellent content. And what is excellent content? Excellent content is heart-centered and integrity content to the best of our ability from day one.
Mm.
And if someone was to ask me what was more important or what's really going on here, I feel that we are developing a model that other energy workers can use. Because many energy workers are excellent in terms of being a practitioner, but the ability to sustain and create their own business is a bit of a challenge.
Mm-hmm.
Because often the philosophies are star-crossed.
Another one of those barriers, right?
A very deep barrier.
Absolutely.
Because many energy workers deal in another currency.
Mm-hmm.
And they're trying to meld both currencies together. And I feel that with Deb and Hi-C and with John and myself, we were able to create a dynamic that's basically a model. And we used to laugh. At least I used to laugh. And maybe I was laughing at myself. I'd be here. As John would say, I have no idea what we're doing here. I don't know it's working.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if it's the tea. I don't know if it's the nice lunch. I don't know if it's because we're all sitting in comfy chairs. I don't know why, but I do know that this is healthy and the energy is really good. We're all showing up every week. We haven't missed any time, and we're getting the message out there and feeling good about it.
And what I was wrestling with was, yeah, okay, so.
And also, you know, when you talk about the dynamic between all of us, you know, for some of us tend to be a little more perfectionist and goal-oriented. And if that person was doing it by themselves, I might venture to say that a radio show would have never happened because they keep waiting until they have it perfected or until they know exactly what it's going to be. And it's going to be in the perfect quality and they have to know exactly what the format is going to be. And they're never going to put a show out there until they have all of that in place, which probably means, and I don't think that's unique to any one individual. I think there's a lot of people like that that think it has to be something before they ever put something out rather than allowing it to develop and grow. And I would make a guess that perhaps that's the same in business. If you don't just start the business and then it can grow and morph into what it wants to be rather than waiting until you know exactly what it's going to be before you ever start the business, you'll probably never have a business. And
absolutely.
And I saw, well, it was a review. There's a new afternoon show on ABC that just started. It's called Good Afternoon America. They were really clever in the title being a spinoff of Good Morning America. But, you know, one of the things that the reviewer said was, like, they liked the host, they liked the format, but they said there's still some kinks to work out, still some things to figure out in terms of the format, et cetera, but overall they liked the show, you know. And to me that said a lot because if you think even one of the big networks puts something on the air that still has some kinks to work out or some format to figure out, then there's no reason to not just start and you don't have to suddenly be at that level, nor is even people at that level at we already know exactly what it's going to be and how it's going to look, et cetera, versus they're willing to start doing it and then figure it out as they go along. And I think that that was one of the things that hopefully people have kind of, that if they have that kind of idea within them, then just get started. It doesn't have to be perfect. Actually, we were very lucky. Like having Deb, we had access to equipment that made the quality much better. If you listen to a lot of podcasts or a lot of these radio shows, internet radio shows out there, you'll really hear that people are doing it with the most basic of equipment, but at least they're doing it, and they're doing it with what they have, and getting the message out, even if the message sounds like it's coming from a tin can. But at least people are still listening and putting it out there. And so that's what I thought was, that I was very proud of the fact that we did, was we just went ahead and did it and started putting it out there. Within 3 months of sitting down to start from scratch, and 3 months later, we were putting our first show out. So.
Yeah, you just pushed forward. I think that perfectionism is clearly the enemy of entrepreneurism, right? If you sit and you think through at nth level of detail how you're going to make something work, you just never start. And it sounds like you guys have pushed through that major hurdle, not only in terms of your aspiration for the content, but then in, you know, your production mechanics and just getting things rolling. Whether you had good equipment to start with or not, that was a bonus, but you started making things happen. I want to pull out something that you alluded to, Hi-C, and that was, there's some stigma attached. You didn't use that word, but I'll use that word just to be provocative. There's some stigma attached to otherworldly stuff, energy work. You know, in our mainstream world, this is not what you tend to hear about. You get bombarded by capitalist messages that are intent on making a profit. And therefore, the things that can be produced at the lowest cost and can net the highest profit are what you hear the most about. Putting this stuff in a form that people can experience more comfortably, because there's a lot of people out there that either need or want or both alternative views, alternative perspectives, and they'd love to have an easy on-ramp into that experience that is not going to be intimidating or embarrassing or even condescending, right? You know, from a standpoint of, am I a thinker? Do I deserve to even, you know, should I even be, you know, dabbling in this sort of thing? So to that end, I'm wondering about what is the offerings? We're making this available to an audience, but how are you thinking about making the offering more interesting to someone that may not be hanging out right next to you doing this sort of thing themselves? I mean, that's a really, really unique audience. It's pretty finite, you know, energy workers themselves. Or is that the audience? Are you creating content that will help energy workers and healers to be more effective at their craft? Or are you actually seeking a broader community and or audience to directly provide this sort of value to?
I feel that we use the word energy worker, but it depends on what is your definition of a healer. I look at people as human beings, and in being so, we are all healers for each other. So the audience can be as big or small as we want it to be.
From my perspective of what we're offering to the general public and to anyone who might stumble across us, I think the goal is to reach a broader audience, not just specifically a niche of people who already understand the terms, who are already familiar with the topics, but those people that might just be curious and those people that might stumble upon something and go, what are they talking about? And listen for more than 2 seconds and go, huh. Some of the people that Mildred has interviewed, there was a wonderful young woman, she's working with composting. Anyone can compost. You don't have to be an energy worker to compost. You don't even have to particularly care about the environment to compost. It's like less garbage in your trash can, you know. So we are able to touch others and in ways, you know, through the content, through the topics. There's something there for everybody.
We hope you're enjoying this broadcast of Firefly Willows LIVE on Blog Talk Radio. For information on Firefly Willows, please explore our website, fireflywillows.com, or like us on Facebook.
Really, we're now dancing around two different questions, I think, and the one is, are we healing or are we entertaining? And what is the target market? And so is it a very narrow market, which Debbie said no, it's a broader market you'd like to, and are you healing or are you entertaining? Are you expanding the consciousness of this target market? And so let's talk a little bit about that.
Well, I guess, you know, when I think about the nature of the show that I like to produce, it's called Convergence for a reason. I experience and take great satisfaction and joy in experiencing the convergence of science and mysticism. I see so many truths that are articulated in one language through science and are articulated in another language through metaphor, myth, and archetypes. And the more I do, the more I investigate, the deeper I delve into both domains, the more convergence and congruence I find. And, you know, as a person from mainstream conventional work background, really in technology, this is the heart and soul, this is the solar plexus of Western civilization. You know, technology is what made Western civilization what it is. I think I'm not alone in wondering about and seeking to fathom the depths of its meaning and purpose and its underlying structure. And I think I've found a lot of interesting ways of doing that through myth and mysticism. And they're not incompatible. And so it really opens up a whole new domain of exploration and understanding and opportunity when you have both sides of the coin, or both sides of the brain, perhaps, integrated and representing a reality that you can actually touch, taste, and experience and be active in. So am I entertaining? Am I seeking to entertain? Yeah, I'm seeking more. I think I'm seeking to provoke. Hmm. Not in a negative sense. I'm seeking to intrigue. That's what I'm seeking to do.
So maybe there, intrigue. Maybe there is a seam that we can allow as an answer that rides the ground between those two. By the way, I agree with you that there is hopefully an expanding group of people that are interested in delving into, you know, both of these planes and what exists between them. Michael Crichton comes to mind,
mm-hmm.
who was, you know, probably most famous for writing The Andromeda Strain and then Jurassic Park and that series, but started life as a doctor, so very scientifically minded. And my favorite book that of his that I've read is called Travels, and it's really an autobiographical sketch whereby he pushes himself to investigate this other side, the paranormal. And as a man of science, he was deeply rooted in all the, you know, reductionist thinking that we get from science, or we tend to get from science, and yet really was open to exploring what was unavoidable observation in this other domain.
Right. Not rejecting the data simply because it doesn't fit the model.
Correct. Because we all know the scientific method has unfolded new frontiers since we invented it. So why not think about today's magic being tomorrow's law? So you would claim then that there is a worthy domain in terms of the value you provide that sits somewhere in between healing and entertainment, and it may be labeled provocation, but nonetheless, provocation that is expanding and therefore has a healing element, but then also is interesting enough to compel you, and maybe it's good enough just to experience it and, you know, take from it what you may. Anything else on that? Anyone want to haul in?
Well, to the question of healing versus entertainment. Now, if you think of in terms of how things get labeled as where they have to put, you know, for entertainment purposes only, I don't think that that's what we are. At least for me, that's not my goal or my purpose. I would say that we're perhaps entertainment for the soul rather than just passive entertainment that we think of in terms of the mainstream media.
Mm.
From the healing standpoint, it's not that what we do is going to heal people, but my hope, at least for me, was that what we're putting out there is going to help generate and offer to people the tools, the information, the experiences that they may need to heal themselves, or to start down a healing path that they may need to be on, with us perhaps offering signposts or little lights along the way, rather than thinking that somehow listening to our show is going to be the answer or the healing for them. And I think that the way our personalities and our shows have kind of developed, you could almost say that our overall show serves the body, mind, spirit. Because I would say, and it's not that this doesn't exist in all of our shows and in all of us. Let us just relax, people. But I would say that John offers the mind because he is all about stimulating thought and really getting people to think differently and kind of trying to bring different concepts and things together into somebody's mind so that they start to see or think or perceive it differently. I would perhaps say that mine would be the spirit, just because I tend to go more for experiential, and if somebody has listened to my show, so it's kind of sitting there and having an experience, not that there isn't information and things there, but it's more of an experience. And Mildred would be...
Lulabelle over there.
Mildred would be the body, because she's much more focused on the practical application and approach to things. I mean, she's the one that did the thing on composting. So she's, for me, the body is the earth element. So she's bringing in that kind of body aspect. So you put those three together, and the overall show is something that's healing for people, because it's addressing and touching on the various levels and aspects of a person so that they can bring all of those elements into alignment within themselves by listening to our show on a regular basis. I mean, I hope that our shows are entertaining, but I wouldn't think of our show as simply being for entertainment purposes only.
Loaded terms, aren't they? Both entertainment and healing. I mean, and you could write off a lot of entertainment as superficial. You could categorize a lot of healing as connoting too much of a negative need, right, that a lot of people won't even want to associate with, right? But I like the way you've put it. I like the way that you've tied that together. So what I noticed about your work, Mildred Lynn, is that one of the themes that you work in is work-life balance. Mm-hmm. And I think that Heisi is highlighting something notable and of interest to this segue, and that is work-life balance is a practical reality. It's a tool people can use, to varying degrees of success, obviously, to really balance their objectives, their motivations, the way that they apply their energy. And I think having all of this great thought, whether it's focused on mind, spirit, or body, or some combo, it's very nurturing, but we don't have a lot of time for it. So the question is, how do you make time for that? How do you apply some of these lessons or these thoughts in life while you're going about your daily, business and work that you need to do or that you think you need to do, and a mixture of those two, and how do you evolve that?
Well, I'd like to go back to the entertainment versus healing question.
Okay.
And when I first read, is it healing or is it entertainment? When I read entertainment, I bristled.
Mm-hmm.
It was an excellent question, because two ends of the spectrum, and it really made me go inside and discover, well, what actually is this? And from my perspective, it's healing and it's an invitation.
Mm.
So we try to present information for people's consideration in a higher vibration, which could be viewed as a healing vibration, and we invite them in, invite them to be part of a healing conversation. And I also see when we create our shows and we send them out over technology for people's consideration, I do view that myself as a healing tool, as the energy is being transmitted, the life force energy is being transmitted through the beauty and the wonder of technology to whomever's receiving it on the other end. And when they hear those words, they can hit people in their hearts, in their head, in their stomach, anywhere. They could be hit. And once that connection is made, there's an opportunity or an invitation for healing to take place. And my view of healing is simply shifting the vibration to something higher.
In that context, one can think about how it could be equally valuable to someone who feels quite strong and just wants to become stronger or healthier more balanced. Someone who is going through a very difficult time and really needs a lift or needs to center on something new.
The model you were talking about, how do you provide balance? Mm-hmm. And as you were speaking, what was coming to me was the idea of the capitalist model and competition focus.
Mm-hmm.
And the energy model and the cooperation focus.
Mm-hmm.
And really what you're looking to do is to bring together the balance between competition and cooperation. And of course, as that happens and you start to become more one with nature and you start identifying more with nature's ecosystem, then you start to question the competition model even more. So in terms of who would be attracted to our show and who we're aiming for, I feel, and maybe Heisi and John and Deb feel or know, that there are people just at that intersection point where they're just ready to burst through.
Mm.
And the competitive model or whatever in their daily grind, their daily life, is making less and less and less sense to them. And they are open to an alternative voice, but heck, what's that alternative voice? I don't want something way out there, and I don't want something way in there, and I don't want to have to hide behind the curtains in my house.
Right.
So I find with us, when we each have our shows, we all go in at different levels. As Heisi was saying, John is going in at one level, specific type of content and level, I would say.
Mm-hmm.
High C also, and myself also. So I'm hoping that whomever will come across us or through our outreach or through our mailing lists will be able to discern for themselves where they resonate with the conversation that's happening.
I like the centering and the philosophy behind how you're going about creating the value and the cooperation model and the like. I would say the competition then, the competition that may be unavoidable is getting the horses to the water. Whether they drink or not will be up to them and their readiness to absorb this kind of perspective. We started out by saying, what motivated you guys to start this? And I'll say, let's assume that you get into a rhythm and you've got it down and the method and the construction and even the production is pretty self-sustaining. And let's say you had no audience. Would you keep doing it?
Yes.
And because you're getting something out of it yourself.
Of course. Mm-hmm. You don't continue doing something you're not getting something out of. That's not a healthy dynamic.
Right.
And, well, first, if I can just go back for a second, when Mildred is talking about the competition versus the cooperation model, you know, to me, I would label that as what we're trying to do, and I think this is something that is emerging. I could use really esoteric, you know, with a whole new level of human consciousness that's emerging, et cetera. But the words I would put to that is it's the individual versus the community model. And what we're, I think, trying to do is take people out of and beyond thinking individually or it's just about me or what I'm dealing with in the world and seeing it as I'm part of a larger community. And there are things out there that can help me, but then also what can I do to give back to that?
Mm.
And when you use kind of a corporate model comparison, you know, one of the lessons that I kind of go by that I learned from Apple and probably really Steve Jobs and his approach to things was he didn't necessarily, well, I mean, I'm sure this was part of it, but I don't think his primary reason for what he would come up with or invent or envision was, what's the problem? How do I fix it? He was more about how do I anticipate or envision what people need that they don't even realize they need yet. And I think that that in some ways is, I think that's a part of the healing model in general, because a lot of times it's the healer's role to help the person start to delve into or identify what they need to heal that they may not even realize is what needs to be healed. Because it's not, healing isn't about treating the symptom, which is what the person thinks need to be healed. The healer's role is to say, let's look at the root of that, which the person says, oh, I didn't realize that's
the
where
true
it's
healer.
Coming from.
Our medical system notwithstanding.
Well,
our
yes. And so, you know, I think part of what we're offering is something that hopefully touches on or resonates or triggers someone that's listening some area or aspect for themselves that maybe they would have never considered or realized they needed to start either focusing on to heal. I don't think it's just about healing, because it may just be about an aspect of themselves they need to allow to start emerging,
mm-hmm.
To set them on a path that maybe they need to be on that they hadn't really been able to clarify or unconsciously knew but didn't consciously have an awareness of. And, you know, personally, I never worried about the audience, because I always thought, I'm just going to put out what I feel called to put out, what I feel emerges for me that wants to go out there, and it will find the audience that it needs to, and whether that's 2 people or 2,000 people,
mm-hmm.
because, you know, when you're ready, the teacher will come. And so just because somebody isn't hearing it now, that's part of the beauty of the technology, is it rests in the archives and as a podcast, so it's always there. It's not like if I didn't hear the show on the radio station at such and such time, I don't get to hear it.
Mm.
It now has the ability to be heard when it needs to be heard by whoever hears it at that moment. So somebody that hears it 5 months from now or 3 years from now from a show today is hearing what they need to hear from that show at that moment that they need to hear it. And it's only because I was willing to simply put it out there without worrying about who's going to hear this? How am I going to target them? How am I going to get them to hear this now? Because I don't know who may need to hear it 3 years from now. I just know I need to put it out there. And I know that's very non-corporate approach, because they're very much about the now, and we got to sell the now or sell the thing, sell the product now. But for me, this approach is put out what I think needs to be out there or what is telling me that it wants to be out there. And then it's out there, and I let go of it kind of like a little child. I just let it go out to the world, and it will reach who it reaches when it needs to reach them, and I don't worry about that nor have control over that.
I think there are two great distinctions that you make that are, I think, pertinent to this very conversation. And one is, and I can relate to personally, so my mother's an artist, my sister's an artist, I was interested in art all my life, and just finally a couple of years ago started painting. And it took me that long because I was so worried about measuring up to my family's ability to produce art. And the only way I got to start was I just decided to love every stroke and not care about what the outcome was. I wanted to experience that beginner's mind and that flow and what could come of it and who cared. You know, I wasn't painting for anyone else but myself. And that kind of relates back to this other comment I made or a question I asked about, if no one came, would there still be, you know, a harmonic here that was creating energy, and whether perhaps later on more people would be able to enjoy this. So I think that's a good test. I think that's a good test to say, wow, there's great value here. And in fact, I think that can free up the best possible value coming out of a gathering like this. You also talk about the concept of not solving a current problem, but anticipating a root cause that might be solvable with something new that people can't yet ask for. And there is an analogy for sure in business in that, and Steve Jobs has been a pioneer among many others, whereby you say, wow, we're not just going to invent a better widget that competes in the current market. We're going to think about what's next, right? And obviously the greatest inventions have done this. The implication, though, of that, if you care about a market, and see how these two themes are connected, right? You cannot care about your market and just produce to produce, and then come what may, that's cool. If you want to attract a market, what you're offering is something that is anticipating the next need, the burden lies on those that are creating that change to say, frankly, the term is evangelize, right? You're now evangelizing something new. You're trying to stimulate. You're trying to provoke something new that might be shatteringly exciting and needed and necessary and fitting with where people are, but they didn't know what to ask for. That's a different dialogue with your quote-unquote customer because it's not comfortable. It, you know, people have to think differently to find value in doing something in a new way. And
they have to take risk.
Yep.
They have to, you know, you talked earlier about, you used the word stigma, you used the word embarrassment, you used the word condescension. These are all variables in the model of competition that, you know, if it's all cooperative, a lot of these feelings, these threatening feelings, are drastically reduced because there's less judgment, because there's less judging, because there's less competition.
Although, I think we would all acknowledge that what's happening here is you're raising awareness and interest and resonance with what tends to be a subset community that you'd like to help expand, right? I mean, you said it yourself, Heisi, expanding consciousness. I don't think that's too lofty. I think that's right on, right? Part of this is about opening people's minds so that they can have more personal growth and more resonance with others, because that delivers a level of health and satisfaction, frankly, right? The way people experience their world, right? And so, but that today is we would experience, I would think, right? It's a subset of humanity.
Well, but I don't think that that's true, because I think that here's the advantage we have of being in a healing role. What we're tapping into or bringing out in someone is something that is already present in everyone. They just don't have necessarily a conscious awareness of it, and this is just something that is helping to trigger or wake that up within them. And we don't have to identify a particular need. It's something that's accessible to everyone. You don't have to be a part of a certain socioeconomic group or in order to afford the product. You don't have to be part of a certain culture in order to access it or understand it, because it will seem foreign to you, or it doesn't meet a need in your culture kind of thing, because this is much more about, we all have soul and spirit, and therefore this is serving that, and that is something that's applicable to every human. And so to me, there isn't a subset, because this is something that is applicable and ultimately accessible to every human. Well, I should say every being. I'm not even going to just limit it to humans. Mm-hmm. So I mean, in a sense, you could say our target market is 7 billion people around the planet, because there isn't a subset for who needs healing or who needs to allow their consciousness to expand or to emerge or to awaken, because that's something for everyone. Healers, when you feel called to that kind of a role or path, it's not the easiest thing to A, feel called to, nor the easiest thing to decide to walk down that path, because there's a lot that you have to sacrifice. Now, if we think of the word sacrifice, the actual meaning of that word means to make sacred. So by choosing to let go of certain things in order to go down that path, you're actually allowing yourself to become more sacred or to step more into your sacredness. Then you are able to then help other people to become more sacred. But it also is a very necessary path, and we are simply going down it and doing what we can and putting what we have that wants to come through us out there for whoever needs to receive it or hear it when they do.
You know, there's a passage in the Bible, the New Testament, cast your bread upon the waters and it'll come back to you sevenfold, right? It wasn't cast your bread to your target market.
Well, Heisley was saying that about the sacredness and about the origins of the word sacrifice. And what was coming to me as Heisley was speaking was that in terms of my personal experiences, as I started to step into myself, which is really, as I look at this work, I'm growing into my own skin and inviting other people to join the journey and listen to other people's journeys, is that what meant anything to you before ceases to have that weight and value. So if someone's listening and they're saying, oh, I'd like to explore this, but I'm not really interested in sacrifice. I don't want deprivation. If they have that connotation attached to it, then I'd like to offer, and I'd love to hear what you guys, you too, Joe, would like to say about this, is that as you're moving into yourself or into the sacredness of energy work, that you start to shift. Mm-hmm. Your vibration starts to resonate differently, and things that you may have thought that you needed before, the illusion of what you needed before, ceases to make sense inside. Mm-hmm. So you become very full.
Well, it's just like we need to love ourselves before we can love others. We need to understand ourselves before we can understand others. We often forget that step, right?
Mm-hmm. And we often look outside of ourselves to see what everybody else, how they understand us, what they have to say for us or about us, rather than for us to be willing to go in and actually find that for ourselves, because we're afraid of what we might find rather than actually looking forward to what we might find.
Well, oftentimes, in being afraid of what we might find, we're afraid of what we might have to say to the world. There's a challenge in speaking your truth when the people around you know you as a certain thing. And then you come to realize about yourself, well, I'm not that thing. And then you have to actually face the consequences of that acknowledgement. Oftentimes people will say, well, better just not to, let sleeping dogs lie.
Better not to break those contracts.
One
of my favorite books, The Four Agreements, is it Don Miguel Ruiz?
Yes.
That's right there, right? It's when you make these four agreements with yourself, and that allows you not to make so many agreements with the rest of society that will hold back yourself.
Right. But it's scary. There's vertigo in that.
Letting people down is one of the most powerful fears, I think, that people have in the way humans function. We were dependent upon society in ways that have gone beyond our
control. Mothers everywhere understand that guilt is a powerful
motivator. Love it. Oh, let's not go there yet.
But in our effort not to let others down, we often let ourselves down much more.
Absolutely.
That's the horror. We can serve others much more greatly if we don't let ourselves down and stand in that.
Yeah, I wrote down universal, Heisi, when you were talking about the real market is everyone, because you're quite right. There's a universal, quote, need/benefit to what this is about, and it's about opening people's consciousness to receive it and to make the most of it, I think. Exciting stuff.
Enjoying today's show? Want to share it with a friend? Or maybe you've missed one of our previous programs. Well, you can always find the archives of our past shows on fireflywillows.com/live. Stop by and check out High C's previous programs or shows from one of our other hosts, Mildred Lynn McDonald or John Carosella. Our live call-in shows are available too. Join us.
So, if time permits, I'd like to delve into tool sets a little bit. And what I'd like to have anyone who's willing to put themselves under the microscope is talk a bit about their favorite tool. I'm going to call it within their craft, because each of your crafts are a bit different, right? And I use the craft term lovingly, not pejorative, but it's a positive thing. But how have you made that tool more accessible to those who are receiving your craft? Because this also harkens to this whole concept of, you know, for many people, if it's too weird, they don't understand it. But how do you make, you know, I listened to one of the spots, I see, where you were talking about how the tarot can be more gentle than the runes that John likes to talk about. And what I was imagining at that very moment was just the bedside manner of articulating some messages using a tool, but that's your way of making it more accessible for someone. So I'm really curious to see how you've taken some of these tools and brought them into a more receivable form.
I'd love to start it off with a funny story about John.
Oh, my God.
You thought you were off the hook.
Oh,
no, this is a really good. This relates specifically to a very powerful tool. Several years ago, when I first left high tech, I have a high tech background, and entered the energy world, I decided that I'd like to start to interview people that I was intrigued with in terms of how they would perceive the world. And I interviewed a number of people, and one day it came to me, John Carosella. Let's hear what John has to say. So the impetus, or the way that it usually went forward for me, is like, how did you get from A to B? And how did you feel when you were going from A to B? And what scared you going from A to B? And what have you learned going from A to B? This is where I would win. So John did a beautiful interview. And basically, in the interview he did, and it was a written interview, the net was it, was, I don't have a clue what I'm doing. I don't have a clue where I'm going, but this is where I am. It was a very, very comical, down-to-earth, nice voice. And out of all of the interviews that I did with people, John's was the most popular, again and again and again. So I became intrigued once again, and I asked the people who were reading the interview, why do you like John's interview so much? It was a great interview. It did stand on its own. But they said, we could relate to him. Mm. He doesn't have the answers, but he has a path forward to get the answers. And I really liked his voice, and he was comical. And I'll always remember that as a gift that John gave to me, because it was a great teaching. Mm-hmm. Because that's the tool that I find when I'm doing doing healing conversation. I learned the power of the peer-to-peer human voice, mm-hmm, in terms of someone being brave enough to put their story out there with foibles and all.
Not have the answers
and really see the beauty in that and the courage and the power in it. Mm. So that's my tool. Thank you, John.
So to share the real world conversations and perspectives of people that are going through change and not necessarily having all the answers and allowing others to relate to that.
Exactly. Yeah.
Fundamentally, you know, what I hear from Mildred Lynn's story is a willingness to be vulnerable, right? When somebody is willing to be vulnerable to help someone else, that's a very powerful remover of obstacles and dissolver of barriers. There's a lot to it. And it relates in a way to a tool that it's not a tool that I talk about a lot, but it's a tool that I fundamentally view as the center of gravity for my work, and that is empathy. I have personally experienced the most powerful, you know, miraculous events in my life through those times, or in those times when I was able to transcend myself and be the other in such a complete way that I saw things, I learned things, I experienced things that I would not otherwise have been able to experience. And I was able to effectuate change in a way that was transcendent. So empathy is a gift that we're all born with. When we are born, we, you know, modern psychology will tell you the infant is not separate from the mother psychologically. So we know what that's like, and we are trained away from it instead of trained to recognize that there is more than that. We're trained away from empathy instead of being trained that in addition to empathy, there's also self. Empathy is extraordinarily powerful, and it's a tool that everything that I do ends up finding its most powerful generative source within.
Yeah, it's a powerful tool. Like in business and in parenthood, right?
Yeah.
When I see people and they come to me as a leader and say, this person is doing this thing to me and they're in my territory, and I'm like, consider the possibility that they're doing that because they're uncomfortable about something. And figure that out and help them. I have three boys, and when they come home and they get bullied at school or wherever, you know, I say, it's coming from smallness. You know, figure out what that person is doing on the playground, what's burning them. And it's a little hard for the, you know, the young guys to sort of take that as a tool back to the playground. But on the other hand, I think it's something that they've tried out a little bit, and there's some potential there. So I couldn't agree with you more. I think that's very powerful. Tool sets.
I worry mine will sound so mundane now. But my primary tools are probably the tarot. And maybe ritual and magic, if you want to think of those as tools, those are really how to apply. And one of the things that I have always wanted to do, and this is why I offer readings not just in person, but by phone or Skype, you know, and that kind of thing, is to give people an opportunity and an access, no matter where they are, to something like that, if that's what they're feeling that they need, rather than, if I can't be there in person, then I guess I can't do it. And so being able to bring that into the show, for example, by being able to do live readings on air and allow people to call in to get a reading, one, it gives people a chance to maybe try it out without feeling as if they have to invest something, like they're not going to be out a certain amount of money or something, and then find out that it wasn't really for them or the person was a charlatan, you know, or whatever. But also to then help, like with the magic, my goal is always to help create something and offer it that is both usable but doable in an everyday way. So instead of thinking of these kind of topics and these kind of aspects as, metaphysics, it's something out there, it's this, you know, and that kind of thing, you have to have special training and the mysteries and blah, blah, blah. You know, it's like, well, no, you know, like with the magic, you can go and pull a few of the herbs that you have right there in your spice rack in your kitchen. And as long as you're using them and putting them together with a certain intention, then you can do magic in an everyday way. And so that was how I envisioned being able to utilize the show, was to expand the reach, because I'm always good. I'm always hopeful.
Yes.
That is true. I was trying to be
that.
Humble by saying good.
You're leaving a lot on the table there.
But I'm always happy to engage the skeptic. You know, and if someone either comes in and says they don't believe in tarot, let's say, or they don't believe in, or they're afraid of getting a reading, I always say, well, why don't we just do one and see what happens? I'm not going to charge you or whatever. It's just, you know, do it. And that's what I wanted to do with the show, was to try to use these tools to say, here's the kind of information or guidance that they can offer us. And maybe that helps to break down some of a person's skepticism or fear or misperception that maybe they've been ingrained in because of a particular kind of upbringing, that they have been told how to believe or think about certain things, to say, but no, it's here it is. It's just this. And if you turn to it or utilize it in a way of, this is something that can help me, what can I get from it? That's what I'm hoping comes through the show, is these are the kind of tools I can also turn to or use, rather than somehow labeling things good or bad, right or wrong, versus just another tool in the tool belt.
Right.
You have a perspective on this that I think is, you might want to share.
On divination methods?
Yeah.
Well, since you asked. So I've dabbled in tarot and I Ching, a variety of things, just out of curiosity. And what I've learned is that, being a scientist, I've always been skeptical about
destiny and subjecting your future to some randomized variable, which is a lot of what divination methods are all about. And so I was, you know, very quick to reject that in terms of its certainty. But what I learned about divination methods is that they have a great way of highlighting facets of a situation that we wouldn't normally have thought about. And to me, there's tremendous innate value in that alone. So if you're contemplating, I did an I Ching, you know, reading when I was contemplating an organizational change. And what came up didn't change my mind about what I was going to do with the organizational change, but it made me more sensitive to a few factors because it highlighted some things that might have caused me not to do it, but in fact, because I wasn't ready to allow the process to take control over my trajectory, but it illuminated some texture in the situation that I found to be very, very useful. And that's the way I see these things having great, great power and usefulness. Not necessarily predicting the future, not necessarily chaining us to an outcome or to a singular perspective or conclusion, but instead to provide a rich perspective on what's going on. And
well, right, and I mean, I always tell people that even though if we look at future or outcome, that we create our own future, but a reading is to help us see what's going on right now, and if nothing about right now changes, this is the most likely direction things are going. But if we're not aware of those facets, we may proceed in a way that isn't in our best interest or in the best interest of what we're envisioning. Hmm. But we have the opportunity to be able to see that. Astrology, I think, really is a good example of what you were just talking about. Because a lot of people think of astrology as somehow just, that's your destiny and this is what you're going to be and all that kind of stuff. Whereas if somebody was going to make an organizational change, they can consult astrology, and astrology isn't going to necessarily say don't do it or do it, but what it might say is you're thinking of doing it on this particular date. Mm-hmm. If you did it a month later, the energies surrounding that would be much more supportive or beneficial for that. So it's not trying to change your mind or say, oh, don't do this, although sometimes we may get indications not to do something. But, you know, it's just additional information for you to take into account. That you may not have considered or been able to see otherwise. Mm.
Two ways to interpret, for those of us who are, like you and I, have a business history, what she was talking about regarding astrology. Think of astrology as a good lawyer. A good lawyer doesn't tell you not to do something. It tells you the cost and the risk of choosing to do something. Right?
Yeah. So the way I would look at a lawyer is just exactly right. And I might not even pay attention to, like, the timing of the recommendation. But being sensitive to the nature of timing would be what I would for sure take away.
At the very least,
yeah.
Right? Oh, yeah, forgot about that dimension. There's timing.
Yeah,
being,
wow.
Know.
Maybe there's a better time to do this.
I could give you a perfect example of that if you want.
Please.
And I know everybody here has heard this, but... Well, we just finished what's called Venus retrograde, which just means if we looked at a planet, it would look like it's going backwards. Most people know Mercury retrograde, but all the planets have a retrograde. And it started on May 15th and ended June 27th. So during that time, without going into what all the Venus retrograde is about, although it is about value and worth, and so you're reexamining whether something is really worth what you think it is and what it appears to be and that kind of thing and what your relationship with it is. That's going on during that period, but the first and last day of that period, that's when the energies are kind of exponentially at their strongest, so you don't really want to do anything on those days because what you do during that period, you may be affected by. It's like saying, I bought something for $500, and then after it comes out of retrograde, you look back and, you know, if I would have paid $300, I feel like this would have been worth it, but I feel like I kind of overpaid for it because I kind of just got up in the want or the hype or the
it's
whatever.
Practical.
Yeah. But on those first and last days, that's when you would... Well, here's the example that I'll give you. That's when you don't want to do anything. Because what happened on May 15th? Perhaps you do not know. I thought maybe in the business world. So May 15th was the Facebook IPO.
Mm.
If they had an astrologer on staff, they would have known to avoid that day like, you know, the plague for putting that. Because look at what happened.
Mm.
Everybody got caught up in a hype. It became vastly overinflated and overvalued, or at least in perception. It dropped precipitously. It wasn't just like buying into the stock market and you risk, you know, maybe losing on your investment. It was just like, blah, 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 drop, 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 drop.
And then the exponential factor comes in, where now they have all these legal issues because it's like now they're being investigated as to how it was handled and all those kinds of things. So that's a very practical way of how these kind of tools can apply in the real world, mm-hmm. and how they can give us greater insight into other energies and things that we may not be aware of that might be going on that could have very, very dramatic impact. And we still have free will. So, you know, the people at Facebook could have heard that and still said, no, we're doing it May 15th. But that's how they can be very beneficial, not to change your mind, but to allow you to be better informed and make a better decision. Hmm. And I think from the scientific aspect, if we take the idea in quantum physics about even how, what is it that they look at that it changes when it's observed, an atom or something?
Oh, anything.
But with the Hawthorne effect?
Yeah. But that's also what's happening with even a divination tool. That's why you go to one person who does tarot and then you go to another person that does tarot. You can ask them the same question. They may see very different things. But it's how it's being observed. But sometimes the tool itself allows you to observe it differently, which means it can then act or become something different than what it would have been without having been looked at that way.
Well, not all this will fit into the fine print on the tool, but I think not mundane at all. I think these are good examples of how these tools can be made more useful, more accessible to more people, because as we stated, the aspiration here is to let a large group of people, if not all people, expand themselves. And so lowering those barriers to these things is quite profound, actually.
When you're talking about tools, and these fall into the human being tools, John and Hi-C both did a call-in show. It was the first time they interacted together, and they did an excellent job, and people loved them, and I think you guys enjoy doing it.
That was fun.
So I talked to people who listened to the show afterwards, and yes, they said they were, you know, they loved the information, they were great, but there were two comments that were repeated over and over again on a human level. The first one was, oh my heavens, are they ever nice? And the second thing was...
Meaning that we are, or were they asking if
you're... Because they sure as heck didn't show it on that show.
Are they ever nice?
So are they ever nice?
And the second, aren't they nice?
Are they nice? Okay.
I heard it the other way, too.
Oh.
She's Canadian.
Thank you very much for the compliment. They are two very nice men. That was the first thing. But the second thing that really surprised me, it was just surprising that it showed up so consistently, was they really care. And that seemed to be so important to people. So why is that so important? Well, maybe people must live their lives as if they're not cared about, or maybe they don't care themselves. But this was a vibrational theme that came up for both Hi-C and John, which I was really impressed with.
I think it's powerful marketing to distill it.
And I think
it has a powerful marketing value. I think it makes... I may use the term bedside manner, but it makes anything more compelling when it's done with the empathy, right? I mean, we think about, there's that discussion about if you go to a doctor's office and you're feeling lousy and you walk right in and they just hand you a prescription and send you on your way, that doesn't feel so good, right? But if they ask you a bunch of questions about how you're feeling and actually put forth some effort, maybe they would have been right, that there's an outbreak going on, you have exactly the same symptoms, I have lots of data that knows, you know, my statistics suggest this will be the fastest way to get you on your way and get you healthy, but that wasn't a good experience. Mm-hmm. Right? You want to feel that that diagnostic effort and that empathy coming forth in the offering.
But it also speaks to the competition thing. And if a healer is also healing themselves and moving down that path for themselves, even while helping other people, then they're letting go of the competition, which, well, from a Buddhist standpoint, would be the ego. They're letting go of the competition of, I need to impress this person. I need to dazzle this person and show them I'm the best healer for them. Or the healer who thinks, I can fix this person. I can heal this person. I can't heal the person, but I can help facilitate their process and give them tools. And I think that's what we're doing with the show.
I think that's a great point, because these things tend to feel like very heady stuff that only it can be performed by those that are the practitioner, so to speak. I was an industry analyst a long time ago, and what I learned about the industry analyst business was it was a lot about ego and a lot about maintaining a sense of, you need me to solve your problems.
And I hated that. I didn't want to operate that way. And I had the satisfying experience of trying to be different about that, right? So like you're talking about, if you're literally being vulnerable yourself as a provider of something, whether it's healing or what have you, they sense that. And that's part of the formula. And in fact, it is the opposite of condescension. It is literally the empathy that comes forth. And as long as that doesn't cause the recipient to feel that you lack the credential or you lack the capability to do what you're doing, right? I think that becomes the bit of the seam to manage. But under the right circumstances, having the courage to be vulnerable while providing enough value, and that's what, you know, I try to do as an analyst, but that comes forth.
But they're not mutually exclusive, though.
I don't believe they are when done right. Mm-hmm. I think there's a lot of people that would never go there because they're not secure in what value they're providing, so they would not choose to be vulnerable. And on the other hand, I believe there might be those that truly are uncomfortable being where they are and aren't able to provide value, and that comes through, right? But one, I think, best surrounds their thoughtful value with that formula for empathy and openness and vulnerability, and then, wow, it's so much easier to receive, right? It's like, wow, I like this person really is good at this, and I feel good about our exchange. I don't feel like I, you know, had to pay a master and feel lowered by that experience. I felt I was talking to a peer, another human.
Mm-hmm. And to not be in competition with other healers, because it's a community of healing and healers. And I'm not worried if somebody comes to me, because I have a client that always comes to me and says, well, I cheated on you. I went and saw another psychic. And I'm like, well, good. What'd they say? And let's work with the information that they also gave you. Because I don't feel like I'm in competition with what anyone else is doing. As if, well, I want to take their business, or I don't want somebody that's seeing me going to them, because what if I lose that person as a client, etc. I see us all as, we're all individual tools in the healing tool belt. And therefore, people just go to who has what to offer them that they need at that moment. And I'm not threatened by that, nor do I feel like I have to somehow one-up that. Mm-hmm. Oh, well, if they, you know, I'm not saying, tell me what they told you, so now let me see what I can tell you that'll dazzle you even more, kind of thing, versus let's bring that right in and have that be a part of the mix and utilize that right there as well.
That's another thing that forming our group for the radio show, that's been, from my perspective, absolutely amazing. And I think it has a lot to do with, as High C says, we're focused on the task. Mm-hmm. We support each other, and we've done this in a sustainable way. And I know I'm always saying that to you, John, I'm surprised we're not all fighting here. But we're not, and it's genuine. And I'm always amazed, like when one of us is doing a show on Sunday morning, even if we have other things to do, no one has ever been left alone. You know, even last Sunday, I thought I would be away, but I was listening to High C show, and Deb, you thought you'd be doing something else. But
great show last week,
yeah,
by the way. That was
yeah.
awesome, High C.
And I don't think that it's exclusive, looking at it through a business lens. I think a lot of people get stuck in that way of thinking of there's business corporate side, and then there's healing, energy work, metaphysical side. But I think that they have something to offer both, and a lot of people have learned to take business aspects into the metaphysical side, even if it's just how to structure and run a business to be like my own person, have my own business doing something.
Yep.
But what my hope is that people in the business realm and a business mindset will see the value and benefit of also allowing this other approach and tools and way of thinking to come into the business way of operating.
Mm.
Rather than just seeing it as woo-woo or superstition or silliness or whatever, versus there is real value, just like I was trying to give the example with the astrology.
Yep.
There is real value in that and can be easily applied to the business side of things if people would just be open and receptive, like you were saying, to allow that to come in and be part of it, rather than always seeing this either or.
Yeah, and at the same time, it needs to work in the other direction, because there's a very real requirement for sustainability in the domain of, you know, energy work and healing work and holistic stuff. And there are business toolkits, perspectives, disciplines that are not incompatible with doing the work that a lot of us just don't know how to do, don't want to do, or don't have the discipline to do, that cause us to not be able to sustain ourselves in this business.
Oh, I think that 95% or greater of the businesses out there have tons to learn and major problems to solve that would benefit from these things. And I think that there's enough evidence of an emergence there, and I think business has evolved quite a bit over the last 200 years.
Mm.
And there are progressive businesses, and I think they shine some light on what's possible. And they're not all progressive in this dimension, but they're progressive, you know, in different dimensions, and including this dimension, right? There, I use the term groovy a lot, raised by hippies from Southern California, but... And I don't mean that I love groovy. I like to go there. But most of business is not groovy. And it's trapped. It's trapped in a weird cumulative set of structures and agreements made and contracts made with other things that get in the way of this.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that to me, that's what has always compelled me to leadership, is to shatter those things and to... You know, try to create an atmosphere, because it tends not to be created for you by the average person, is to create that empathy, create, you know, that atmosphere for receptivity and collaboration. Business is a market, for sure, for these things. I would assume that a fair amount of your work I've seen a lot of your work in the business world,
mm-hmm.
let's put it that way. You know, coaching,
mm-hmm.
you know, sort of, you tend to see a lot of it at the executive level, because executives tend to have more money to pay for it. But
and they also have more disposable discretionary time. You know, when you're working lower down the stack, there's a tendency to have a more prescribed, fewer degrees of freedom, in a sense, right? You have to get X set of things done, and it's not under your discretion whether you do or don't. Whereas you're an executive, you have a whole pile of obligations that are, you know, both important and urgent. But at the end of the day, a big part of that is your own call.
And I would say the same dysfunction I'm talking about in business makes most of those executives not be able to make that call. They may be in charge of their schedule. They don't choose to be because they're subject to the urgent but maybe not so important.
Yeah. They are subjugated.
And in fact, you could argue that they have more potential obligations, and so they have to be even better at managing that balance.
Yeah, that's true.
And they tend not to be. And that's therefore they are, that's why there's a market there.
Yeah, fair enough.
And I think every company should have at least one tarot reader or astrologer or something on staff. Both for the high level, but then have one like in HR, because those kind of people can be great counselors, but can also be really good at understanding why and how people are acting or reacting in ways that they are, and then see the better way to try to deal with that or to work with that or to overcome that. Because, well, here I'll use astrology terms, but you'll see like what's in opposition versus a square. It was interesting because that's actually the symbol that you made was this when you were talking about these two
axes,
two things trying to come together.
Yeah.
And in astrology, that's worse than this. We often think of the word opposition, which means two things opposite 180 degrees from each other. We think of that word as, oh, how are we ever going to deal with that? That's going to be a really big fight.
Hmm.
But what it shows us is that there's a you can meet in the middle. So things in opposition in astrology, you're looking at where is the balancing point for those two things. When they're in a square and they hit it 90 degrees, that's the most difficult aspect in astrology, because it's just one thing going one way and one thing going the other way, and
the
you're just like butting heads.
Very tiny.
So sometimes you could see that there's charts called synastry. They're used for relationships where, like, if you and I were in a relationship, whether it's a personal relationship or a work relationship, you just take our charts and you overlay them on each other, and then you can see where those aspects are.
Mm.
So if you're trying to put a team together and you pop those on top of each other and you see that, well, here's two people that have a square, maybe that's not the best people to have on this particular team at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
Versus oppositions would be okay, because they may be actually bringing in the best of both sides. So
at
we
least
have to
they
find
relate
a way
to that
for them
plane.
To work together.
Right. Yeah.
You know, and so that's why I think it would be very... well served.
Just
for
needs a new name. I was talking to a lady last week at Starbucks. I just bumped into her, and she's responsible for developing a coaching program for teachers. And the challenge that she's facing is that the connotation of having a coach is disciplinary,
mm-hmm.
where she has a whole new program that's positive life force energy.
Mm-hmm.
So she has to get over that barrier of the coach word.
Mm.
So I was suggesting a qualifier, you know, so people would be proud of it. But people immediately bring, if you're talking astrology, they're bringing their meaning of astrology into the room, and sometimes they can't even get past that. But if you were to explain what you're talking about, just without any terms or titles, it just makes so much sense.
Right. Yeah, we're bringing someone in who can look at the underlying interpersonal dynamics
yes.
of the human resource
yes.
department.
Yes.
There's a set of people out there that have budget that would agree that some investment in these services being available to all employees would actually lower their health premiums, lower their health costs. Just like going to the gym, they know, and therefore they find ways to fund it, is actually going to lower their health costs, because they're literally going to improve the health of their people, and that's going to show up in their actuarial calculation, right?
Yep.
There's a lot of companies doing self-insurance, big companies now, and not as big, right? People are starting to take on self-insurance as a way to not pay the middleman,
yeah.
pay the insurance company
right.
for what is, in effect, risk balancing across the population. So I would think that there's a very interesting potential to package some syndicated content. So, you know, there's content that people can experience and just come and hang out and check it out, but then services that they can engage that make them not only healthier, which could affect the health costs of the company, but would also make their interpersonal performance in the company healthier.
Yes. So that's the short-term highest leverage that you can get.
I think the potential challenge is when you highlight that as either the upside benefit or an even more powerful benefit, you then confuse the category. You're back to that problem of solving problems where there's budget versus knowing that there's
right.
a better solution
right.
to the root cause and figuring out how you cope with that, right? But if you allow your, you'll at least want to be mindful of the fact that there's a budget for health costs,
mm-hmm.
there's maybe a budget for coaching, but it has baggage, there's a budget for training, typically, but management retreats and some of that's a very, very fluid thing. It depends upon
management
the leadership.
What?
Retreats.
Management
budget
what?
To do management retreats.
Management what?
Advances. But no, I mean to label it as it's known,
yes.
which is the known, oh, yeah, we got to get people out of the office once in a while, and most people do it very poorly, and I'm very cynical about all this because I've done it for these companies before, and navigating category and figuring out
where the budget is.
Figuring out what the budget is, but then how to disrupt the value proposition in a known budget that you could annex.
Yep. Yeah.
That you could steal.
Or the other way to look at it is
co-opt.
That paradigm may not work
mm.
just because to me it's old
mm.
thinking. And maybe it's to look for progressive, environmentally oriented companies who
oh.
speak to the earth.
Oh yeah.
Peace. So that but that becomes your strategic target market, because you know the barrier to entry will be lower. So you select on those that might be in the green. You know, you could
more
figure
green.
Out how to go
or
after more receptive progressive
if,
companies.
If that was your if that's something you wanted to do. You know, that may not be something you want to do.
Oh, all this is
yeah.
predicated on would you like to package up for
yeah.
the business world?
Yeah, that's yeah.
That's
so
clearly
for me,
an if.
I would be interested in packaging up for the eco-sustainable.
Mm-hmm.
I even have trouble using the word business, because I feel that energetic vibration is not business. It's a sustainable ecosystem.
Now, when you hear the word vibration, as Mildred Lynn has applied it, or what does that conjure for you?
You mean the greater life force that is manifest in vibrations between beings?
Well, it's really an interesting question.
I didn't mean to get in that tone.
Aside from that very businessy definition you just gave, could you tell us a little more what it means to you?
Does it register with you that the word vibration actually has physics behind it that actually does matter? Or is it such a tainted descriptor of New Agey speak that it doesn't even...
Not only that, the average person, if you really want to go after the 7 billion, wouldn't even be reassured by the connection to physics, because they don't know physics. So yes, in the intellectual elite, it's good fodder. But the mass market needs things to be brought down to very, very simple terms.
Or analogies that they can relate to. It's
right.
like a baby's cry. It's like a this.
Right on.
Yeah.
Stories. labels, known artifacts people can resonate with. But getting people to embrace this notion of we're all connected in a field, probably going to be too much. They're not going to, they may ultimately come to learn what that is. I think the gateway has to be festooned with other invitations.
You know, the example I use with people when they say, oh, I don't believe in that energy stuff, or, you know, how do you know that that's real or whatever? And I say, oh, have you ever walked into a room and said, whoa, you can cut the tension with a knife in here? And if they say yes, then they've experienced energy.
Absolutely. That's a great, so there you go. So that's a way to talk about, in a way people will recognize, how energy manifests between people. The chief was talking about the hair and how that, you know, and an example people could relate to, hackles stand on end when there's a tense situation. I thought that was very interesting. This morning while I was jogging, I was visited by three crows. Just after rereading Crow Medicine last night, one followed me. And then a song comes on my iPod, which is talking about, it's a precursor to a Black Eyed Peas song, but it's all about this very topic. Energy is constant, it takes different forms, and blah, 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 blah. But so it was, I was visited on this very day. But
that's encouraging.
I know what to hear. You know, I've invested in this.
Are willing to tune your hearing.
Not only that, there's two things. But I've also learned enough about it to then recognize it when I hear it.
Yeah.
So not only am I receptive, but it's familiar. Mm-hmm. But for the average person, they're going to need these handles.
But maybe, like, here's one thing. Are you interested in using your precious life force energy to teach or just to be there when the person is wanting to open the door? Because it takes a lot more energy to teach.
Well, it depends. Like, you know, being in a store, I think that we underestimate people's awareness or interest in this, because over and over again, I would have people come in and they would say, you know, I keep waking up every morning and the clock says 3:33. What do you think it means? And at least it causes them to be curious. And that's where I think you have to be ready to teach. It's not, you have to teach.
Oh, no, but they're open. That's an open teaching. But when I'm listening.
Why'd you say 3:33? Why'd you say that? I'm dead serious. That relates to my run. So I stopped my clock and it was 33 minutes and it was 1.17 seconds off of 33 minutes, 3 seconds, and 33 hundredths.
Anyway. Well, then I would say pay attention to the three. Three is the number. What do you need to be?
By the way,
what do you need to be optimistic about? What do you need to be looking forward into the future about? What do you need to be birthing and bringing into being at this time? What has gestated long enough, and now it's time to actually push? I'm thinking I need to hold on to it any longer.
Is that what three is about?
There you go.
Earth creation. It's the first sprout of growth.
Mm.
So it's time for it to start coming out into visibility.
Firefly Willows LIVE is proud to support Mikaboo Companion Bird Rescue. Founded in 1996 and operating throughout the greater San Francisco Bay Area, Mikaboo is a rescue organization for parrot type and other domesticated companion birds. Their volunteers, the heart and soul of Mikaboo, are dedicated to rescuing companion birds who have been neglected, abused, injured, or surrendered to them, with the ultimate goals of rehabilitation and rehoming these feathered beings. Mikaboo offers bird education classes to people interested in adopting a rescue bird, as well as to the general bird-loving public. Find them at www.mikaboo.org. Mikaboo is spelled M-I-C-K-A-B-O-O, or email them at mail@mikaboo.org. Information on how to make a donation to help the birds can be found at www.mikaboo.org, or by emailing donations@mikaboo.org, M-I-C-K-A-B-O-O. This tip of the week from Mikaboo Companion Bird Rescue. Because birds are prey animals, they hide symptoms of illness and injuries for as long as they can. By the time a bird acts sick, it's almost too late. Take your bird to an avian vet regularly for well bird checkups. And if you think he's acting very differently than normal, take him to an avian vet immediately. Want to learn more? See Mikaboo's website, mikaboo.org. That's M-I-C-K-A-B-O-O.org.
And retreat actually doesn't always have to mean going backwards, because retreat also just means to
going
pull
backwards
back
is not bad.
Yeah,
well,
I mean it's stepping out.
Example.
Well, it's stepping out and stepping away. Well, I could. but sometimes I think that. See, this is where I have my issues with the corporate world. I have a few. First, in how they assess the value of something, because I would see offering a retreat may be just as valuable the same way that somebody takes a mental health day, where they call in sick, even though they're not really sick, because they just need a day to regenerate, to refresh, to recharge, to just, or downtime.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes that's, well, I think ultimately you get something from that if you have healthier people, happier people, et cetera. But there may not be any direct return on the investment of doing a retreat like that. And I think that it can't be always so strictly measured in that way. And maybe sometimes doing the retreats, like when she was talking about the ego stuff, and a lot of times, and it's because my partner, Jeff, I mean, they do these kind of things too, you know, it's like, oh, they go bowling for the afternoon or they go to a Giants game or something.
Yeah.
I think it's good to foster interpersonal dynamics and morale and everything. But why not do that, say, where it's a day of taking the team, the group, to work for Habitat for Humanity, to be building a house for a day. And then the money, because you really don't have to pay to do that, but take the money that might have been budgeted for, say, going bowling, and you make a donation in each name of the persons on the team to Habitat for Humanity. So they've all, that's the contribution, that's where the money goes. But they also have now engaged in something that has probably a lot more personal meaning or fulfillment. And actually what made me think of that is there's now a dating organization called Matches That Matter. And they have a group of like six people, so it'd be like three women and three men. Well, we can see what model they're working from. But anyway, they'll bring like six people together. But instead of it just being about let's organize, you know, everybody sitting around tasting wine, they'll have them go and say all volunteer for a Saturday afternoon at a food bank.
Mm-hmm.
And then have them all go and do some other, you know, like beach cleanup or, you know, but it's that's why they call it Matches That Matter, because they're doing something that's more...
Yep.
Than just get together, get drunk, and oops, who ended up in whose bed, and now are we actually going to see a relationship develop from that kind of thing? But I think that could easily be applied over to
any other thing.
And I always wonder why that's not thought of or done more. And I know some people are going to go, oh, I have to take a day off, but that means I have to go build a house. But I think that if you actually get people to do that, they're going to get a lot more out of it and realize, and not think that way once they've actually done it versus the perception beforehand, or assuming that's what people are going to do, say, or think, and then not doing it because we don't want anybody saying that.
I think one of the reasons is just default lack of creativity and the people that are in charge, and or there isn't someone hawking that option. Right, so you either have it inside or someone outside is hawking it at you. That is how lazy business is. So while you were talking about it, I was thinking, wow, what if there were a free? We got to think in terms of free, right? But and somehow getting money off ads. I mean, at the end of the day, that's one of the unavoidable economic models today. But if you had an offering that was free, that would clearly establish value and that they would get hooked on it, that is the on-ramp to value these days, right? There's a free version of everything, and then there's a premium version. Right, and so you say, hey, we know that this is going to be worth your time. Now you have to sell them on investing their time in something that's free. that's the selling, but it lowers at least an economic barrier. But what if it were merely matchmaking, these sorts of things? Like, say, hey, what? You should go do these. We have three options for you, and we can connect you to Habitat for Humanity. And here is the way that we route your request and the quantity of people and the date that you put in here over to these guys, or we could equally route it to beach cleanup or option number three, right? And that might even be part of the syndicated offering, where so you're starting to collect some of these services and you're transforming the health state of
the
business,
community.
Of the community that's trying to perform a business, but now will benefit from some of these things, and some of them involve, you know.
Oh, I see. Yeah.
The appeal there for the business is already that it's free. Because you don't pay to do those things. You know, Habitat for Humanity isn't charging you to come and utilize their facility to build a house.
Right.
You then have the option of how much you want to spend or whether you spend anything by then, say, making a follow-up donation in each person.
And a portion will donate nothing. A big portion will donate nothing and just...
Other than their labor.
But what they're giving by the time and the labor is still...
something that the organization needs that they're
Absolutely.
Doing it for. So whether they get money or not, the money becomes a nice byproduct.
You've just created value out of nothing for the business. So, right, they take what they might have spent money on, they get a better activity, a more meaningful activity for their people, and it's less.
Right. It's
so there, and this model, this community model, has other examples of that. And maybe there's a great value in facilitating the known benefits of the community working together to say, hey, I know you need so-and-so over here, able to provide that, and some of those matchmakings. And
look at the word you just used.
Yeah,
community.
Yeah.
It wasn't about how do we serve the individual needs of the people on the team and the business. It says, how do we as this business community, meaning the company, community, go and serve the need of this community by bringing community together with community, rather than being so worried about the individuals and how are we going to make sure that they're all happy and all of that kind of thing. You just approach it and you offer it as a community to community. It's the C2C versus the B2B business.
But also what's going to happen with that is when people are giving, and that starts to impact on a soul level, they're giving as part of the community, then they're also, that's the model that's going to start making sense to them because they're going to like how that feels spiritually on their soul level, and that's going to make a competitive model start to make less sense to them. So you're going to be seeing, you'll see shifts.
And even if it's like going into an old person's home,
yeah.
you know, You can get the team, actually. The team gets really excited because if you give them the creativity, okay, we're going to have, you know, 3 hours, and what we want to do is we want to entertain these people so we can put on a play, we can sing, we can, you know, do this, that, and the other. But everybody suddenly gets excited about working together to try to come up with a play to put on or you know, what they're going to sing or all of those kind of things. And so it engages them, and, again, it's not costing the company anything, but it also is going to really boost the people, I think, more so than if they all get to go sit and have hot dogs while watching a Giants game. And I'm not there can be benefit in doing those kind of things as well. I mean, there needs to be a nice mix. Can't always be out building a house every time. Oh, great. Building our morale again by doing physical labor. I mean, every once in a while you want
to
mix
it
up.
That's what the Pharaoh was always all about when they're building the pyramids. He was building morale.
Lots and lots
That was underhanded.
But actually, that's a. If I use the Egyptian example, because they weren't slaves, and so it was actually the community serving.
They were guests.
No, they weren't. They came from the community, and it's the same with a lot of the temple personnel. Is because there was a season of flooding, and because it's such an agricultural society. The season of flooding, you can't really be doing much when your primary thing is farming or something agricultural based. So the majority of people would then work in the temple for 1 month. It was either 1 month every 4 months or something like that. But you're serving the community on the bigger scale because you're coming from the community and now serving a larger community. And like building the pyramid, you're actually serving the greater good of Egypt itself because of what that was going to bring and what those were meant for and all of that kind of thing.
So they were shifting to a tourist economy from an
You can engage people in understanding they're serving a bigger community, and then they're willing to do that rather than seeing it as some sort of great burden. And I'm not saying that those people building the slaves weren't under great burden with the heat and the physical labor and all that kind of stuff, but there was still this willingness and understanding, which I think we could foster within the business world.
Yeah. Service, I mean.
Well, people, I don't know which study it was, but it was people are afraid of being diminished and their voice not being heard and not being valued and not valuing things and not providing value. There's lots and lots of research around that. And I would say identifying with a group who went and did something for others has got to be a good feeling that people would be proud of. And they can say, I go to work every week, I feel like I'm a clog in the wheel, but on this day, I went and helped other people and it made me feel good. And then they're walking a bit taller, you know, so you're empowering.
Yeah. I mean,
the value thing.
I think our competition mindset, as you were saying before, Heise, tends to drive people to think more about what I can achieve personally
and you lose that experience of how empowering it feels. It's so ironic, right? You're seeking this power through your own accumulation and your own score in the big game, and yet the most empowering things that you do are for others.
Right.
And we lost sight of that on a grand scale. And so finding ways to say, aha, you know, you could change a few of the things that you do as a company to tap into that power. Turns out to be cheaper than what you've been doing. Someone will charge a lot for it.
You know what would be really interesting is what we were talking about last week, which is, it's called the gift circle.
Hmm.
Yeah. And to apply that concept to, say, a team in a company.
Yep.
And so in a gift circle, I don't know if you know, but this example is from Marin, but as a neighborhood, they would come together once a week, and there was like 10 people or something, you know, in this neighborhood. Well, I mean, there's more than that, but representatives from each family or whatever. They would come together and sit, and you go around like three times, and you say, this is what I received in the past week. This is what I need in the coming week. So it may be that I need help painting my bedroom. I need a ride to the airport. And then you go around the third time and say, this is what I have to offer. So if I heard you say you needed a ride to the airport next Tuesday, I said, oh, I could take you to the airport. And then you might say, or somebody else might say, oh, yeah, well, I'm off next Thursday from work, so I can come over and help you to paint. And so it'd be interesting in a business environment to see how that might work. If you brought the people together for like a weekly meeting and you went around that way, and if somebody said, well, I really need help getting this particular such and such finished, and somebody else says, oh, you know what,
task.
I'm finished. Yeah, yeah. And somebody says, oh, you know what, I'm finishing my project on Tuesday, so I can come help you with that on Wednesday so that you can finish that, because I'll have just finished my thing, and before I start something else, I can come help you. And then somebody else might say, oh, well, you know, I can go, sounds weird, you know, I can go pick up your daughter from daycare and bring her back here for you since you're going to be in that meeting on Thursday, you know, or whatever. But it'd be interesting at how that concept might be able to be applied even in a business setting.
Trust is required.
I think that, plus in a business setting, there is specialization of labor. And whereas in the neighborhood setting, all the things that people need tend to be common consumer things.
Well, I don't think that's true, because I could say that, oh, I need the wood railing on my deck fixed, and I don't know anything about how to use tools.
No,
and you say, oh, you know what? I'm great with tools. I build stuff with wood all the time, so I'll come over there and I'll do that for you. And that's your specialization that you can now offer me. And in return, I may be able to offer you something that you either wouldn't have access to or just wouldn't necessarily do for yourself.
It would certainly work. I think it's a fair counterpoint. I think it would certainly work well in groups, like functional groups, for sure, because they're all on projects and they're doing oftentimes pretty similar things, where their ability to navigate and help is
higher. That's what I was thinking. Like, you applied it in.
You could prototype there.
Yeah.
And then see how much, you know, what the asks start to appear to be.
But I think you could expand it though, and you could bring both. You could say, so wow, you know, like the classic executive admin often does a lot of personal things for an executive.
Right.
So what if the team were helping each other out with their own home burdens, because work-life balance is one of the things that's hard to manage.
It's
and
a
so,
perfect example.
Hey, you know, I can help take your daughter to the airport next week or something like that. And so now you get this really human,
you know,
empathy.
What? We've said the word several times, and it's something that you use all the time. The key is work-life balance. If you use that phrase, you have access to budget.
We're a work-life balance enabler.
Services, work-life balance services, right? Like, that's HR, it's team building.
Because they understand it.
I think that, at least initially, I think that's most successful in small groups. And that's why I was thinking, like, you would just take the marketing team, and they would get together once a week, and that's when they would do their circle, and the sales team would do it over here, and the engineering team over here. It wasn't about have like a whole company of 500 people all getting together for an all hands meeting once a week, and you're gonna go around and say, you know, what people need.
Yeah.
But if you keep it,
if
you keep it small, well, even if somebody said that, maybe in the small team, like if we were the marketing team, I might say, this has nothing to do with work, I might say, you know, even though we're doing it in a work setting, I might say, oh, you know what, I've got this dinner, I have 7 people coming over for dinner tomorrow night, and I've got to get everything made, and I don't know if I'm going to have time to go to the store, and the one thing I forgot to get was lemons, because I'm making a lemon meringue pie. And what you might say is, oh, I have a lemon tree, I will bring you a bag of lemons tomorrow.
And so suddenly we've resolved that issue, which means the person doesn't have to leave work to try to get to the store. Mm-hmm. The person now can relax because they're not worried or stressed that they're
more
not going to have what they envision having for
like
the dinner.
They're making lemonade and lemons.
Exactly. And so it goes to the work-life thing.
Always a source of energy.
Because whether it's something I have to offer for a project you're working on in the work setting or something I have to offer you in the life setting that will make your life a little easier or take a little stress off of you, which obviously means that they're going to then be a little more productive or a little bit better in the work situation, you know, I don't see why that couldn't work in that environment.
Well, as I've said, I think that you have something unique there, and I've imposed a lot of business lenses on this just because that's where I come from. But in business, you look for value that's hard to reproduce, and that sustainable value that's hard to reproduce produces success in business. And this is not business per se, although it'll have some dependency upon on how you choose to sustain it, but you have a formula and you have a resonance and a harmonic that I think is hard to produce, and therefore it is valuable, and I think you'll continue to grow it. So this has been an honor to be part of this discussion. I hope to come back and check up on you and maybe do this again sometime if you'd have me. And I wish you well pursuing that audience of 7 billion people that could do quite well to expand consciousness in a way that you folks talk about.
Thank you, Joe.
Thank you, Joe. It's been great to have you here.
Joe, if you could describe us in 3 words, what would they be?
Body, mind, spirit.
Good.
Thank you for joining us on today's episode of Firefly Willows LIVE. We hope you enjoyed the show. Join us next week as Mildred Lynn McDonald hosts Healing Conversations. First, Mildred Lynn chats with Ray Hatherton, author of Alive, An Energy Plan for Life, which launched in 2011 as Amazon's #1 book in the alternative medicine category. Then join her conversation with new mom, naturopathic doctor and owner of Balanced Naturopathic Health Center, Dr. Glenna Calder, about attachment parenting and what type of parenting really matters for the health and well-being of babies and mothers alike. In our What's Your Prescription for Balance segment, Mildred Lynn shares game-changing strategies from the Pachamama Alliance Global Conference being held in Petaluma, California this week. Our Firefly Willows LIVE roundtable topic for next week will be, are you an inspiration to yourself? This is Deb Caracella. Please join us next Sunday morning at 10:30 a.m. Pacific Time on Firefly Willows LIVE, Blog Talk Radio.